What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Scottish writer Irvin Welsh stormed onto the literary scene with his debut novel Trainspotting in 1993. Trainspotting's 1996 movie adaptation followed Welsh's book into a group of hard-living friends, heroin addicts, on the rough side of Edinburgh, including Ewan McGregor as Renton.
We took morphine, diamorphine, cyclizine, codeine, temazepam, nitrazepam, phenobarbital, sodium amytal, dextropropoxetine, methadone, nalbuphine, pethidine, pentazocine, buprenorphine, dextromoramide, chloromethiazole. The streets are awash with drugs you can have for unhappiness and pain, and we took them all.
His latest novel, The Bedroom Secrets of the Master Chefs, goes darkly for the soul, like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and Oscar Wilde's Dorian Gray before it. Irvin Welsh joins me now in the studio. He's touring the U.S. and will be in Chicago, Austin, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle in the days ahead. Novelist David Foster Wallace calls Irvin Welsh the real thing, a marvelous mixture of nihilism and heartbreak, pinpoint realism, and almost archetypal universality. Irvin Welsh, welcome. Thanks for being here with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Well, that's great. We've got a little bit of your old music in there, and we've got a little bit of Ewan McGregor laying out that list of substances.
It fair takes me back, yes.
Here we are. They, you've been called the high priest of the chemical generation. Is that still your moniker?
Yeah, I mean, I've been called so many things, and I think if I paid attention to them all, you know, my head would be kind of spinning around. I'd never get a sort of handle on anything. But, it's kind of flattering in a way to be given this kind of exalted thing of this, you know, these priestly powers. But I do get a lot of people trying to confess to me as a result. But
I'm not sure on what substance. And I know that they turn out in droves. You've got a following that's just intense in this country and well beyond. We should take us into the new book and the turn that you've taken, if you call it a turn. I mean, you had Trainspotting and Ecstasy and Filth and Glue and Porno and all hitting that button again and again, the sort of raw, raunchy sex, violence, depravity, the downside, the tough side, looking for the light in there, or at least the truth in there. What's the turn you take? How do you describe it in The Bedroom Secrets of the Master Chefs? A lot more words in the title, for one.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically about two guys who hate each other, and they're trying to understand and come to terms with the extent of their rivalry. When I was writing the book, originally I thought about guys in their 40s, but I realised that they actually had to be in their early 20s, you know, and not quite formed of character yet, and they're still in that kind of storming stage where they're kind of marking out the kind of person that they want to be. Mm-hmm. So they have this unfathomable kind of hatred of each other, and it's highlighted to such an extent that one of the guys puts a curse on the other guy.
He puts an actual curse, a hex.
Yep, and... Mm-hmm. He kind of, by doing that, it enables him to give his hangovers. You know, he can carry on and party and carouse as wantonly as he likes, and the other guy takes his hangovers. So it's a bit like kind of a portrait of Dorian Gray, but without having instead of having the picture in the attic, he's got this kind of sort of nerdy wee model railway enthusiast in the attic who's taking all the hangovers for him.
And it's all the more compelling in that duality because, as you say, the guy who takes the hangovers is... the sort of nerd straight guy. He's not carousing, but he suffers the pain.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically kind of trying to get... You mentioned duality, and it's always been a big theme in Scottish literature from Robert Louis Stevenson's The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, mm-hmm. James Hogg's Confessions and Memoirs of a Justified Sinner. So it's just been a huge thing, and it fits in with the whole kind of Scottish or British kind of sort of schizophrenia that you have in Scotland. In literature, there has always kind of mirrored that. And I kind of wanted to get to this this thing about about the kind of the total self-defeating kind of irrationality of hating somebody, because if you hate somebody, it implies that you've got to be in a relationship with them, you know, as intense as love, and it takes a lot of energy, and it's a responsibility in a way, because you've got to be there with them, you've got to kind of be obsessed with them. And kind of extrapolating that onto the whole sort of political thing, it's like, you know, you can see it as like the West and the Middle East, you know, if you don't like somebody or what they're doing, you're probably better just leaving them alone rather than becoming obsessed with what they're about.
In this case, it doesn't start with a love relationship at all. I mean, they're just working side by side. Describe the two main characters for us, Danny Skinner first and then Brian Kibbe.
Yeah, Danny Skinner is a kind of boy about town. He's a very stylish kind of young guy. He's got a sort of nice-looking girlfriend. He's reasonably good job
at the Edinburgh Council in the housing Council. And following up on restaurants and
he's a restaurant inspector.
That's
basically
right.
And he's got a decent job, but like a lot of people, there's another side to him. Another side to him is that he's a Hibs football casual. He's prone to that.
Hibs, now to translate for us here.
Hibs is a Hibernian football club who have got a kind of notorious gang of football casuals, like organised football hooligans in Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. And he's one of their members, and he's also a tremendous drink problem that seems to be getting on top of him now. And this is what he's trying to sort of find out. He knows that his father, he's got an absentee father who he's never met. His mother won't say anything about his father, but he knows that his father was an alcoholic. So he's trying to work out, is this his father's curse? Is it a kind of thing that's been passed down from father to son?
And here's a kind of classic Irvine Welsh character. I mean, he's hard living, he's angry, and he's out there on the edge whenever he can get there.
Yeah, he is. But he's also got that kind of thing that, unlike kind of say the other people that I've written about, like kind of Renton and Roy Strang, and he's also got that kind of that bourgeois pretension as well. He wants to actually get on, at the
dress
same
a
time,
little nicely, you know, and make the right impression.
So he's got that kind of contradiction within him.
On the other side, Brian Kibbe, Star Trek enthusiast, video game aficionado, does not drink, does not smoke.
Doesn't drink, doesn't smoke. Lives at home with his mother. Feels guilty about kind of touching himself, hasn't had a girlfriend, is a virgin, is just very much the kind of, these two characters to me kind of very much represent what kind of Scotland is. It's this kind of sort of bad guy and this archetypal Mr. Nice Guy, and so much of the whole Scottish social life to me has been a battle between these two forces, basically, and they kind of embody these two forces, and they embody that kind of society.
Mm-hmm. You've called the book a treatise on hate. What are you looking to learn or to share? What's the news?
Well, I think the kind of thing is that kind of what I was saying about the fact that you think it's an easy option to hate somebody, but it's not. It's actually a kind of very sort of implies it's a big relationship you're entering into, and it's also got a lot of ramifications. I mean, it's like kind of I think probably in the real world, and as in the book, I mean, Skinner, he's not just putting the curse on Kibbe, he's actually putting the curse on himself as well. And I think that's the kind of moral of the book, really, that the ramifications of hating somebody go way beyond what you would expect them to be. And it is, you have to be kind of in there for the long haul, because once you set your stall out that you hate this person so much, you really have to follow it through, because you've set yourself up in that kind of way.
Do you see the hate factor growing? Is that what's taken your antenna to it? You started out with very deep in the music world and with the drugs and disillusion, even depravity, but now hate suddenly. Why is that on your screen?
Well, I think that people are kind of we kind of sort of feel that we're burdened with this 3 score in 10, so we become obsessed with our own lives, and we also, to try and get the most out of our own lives, you know, we've caught up in this huge culture of consumerism, but we're also looking at other people and constantly sort of evaluating ourselves by them and judging them and saying, there's this kind of rivalry that's built in, rivalry at work, rivalry with material sort of goods, and rivalry with rivalry in love, rivalry in everything practically. So there's this kind of built kind of competition that we have in our society that when it manifests itself at that level, you know, that level, it can become pathological. And I think it's I think that this kind of hate has got the potential to exponentially grow in the kind of world that we live in. So I think it's a cautionary tale as well.
To grow, what, the whole world getting in the pressure cooker somehow?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the way we live now, I mean, it's like Skinner is the kind of guy who, his mother would have said to him, oh, you've done well, son, you've got a good job. But all he sees is he's gone into this place, he's got massive debts, he's paying it off with a credit card. He's like so many middle-class people that they've, you know, that going to college and getting a good job was this panacea. But when all they've got is a string of debts, and they're tied into this kind of way of life, into this rat race that they can't really escape from. So they just have to keep going on and be more competitive be a bit kind of harder to get the job that the other person, you know, that the rival was maybe going for as well. So it's kind of it's a bit about the way we've got into this whole self-defeating culture here in the West.
And watch out when you crank up the hatred, because it can loop back around, and we see that. David's calling from Lowell, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air with Irvin Welsh.
Yeah, hi Tom, how are you?
Very well, what do you think?
I want to say I haven't read Mr. Welch's books yet, but I'm definitely going to after this phone call. The reason I'm calling, and I don't know if it's appropriate or not, you know, I'm in one of the sort of social garbage collection professions. I've been a detective for 20 years.
A police detective, all right.
No, I'm a private investigator. I'm usually working for the defense.
Private investigator, PI for the defense. Okay, so you see that you see Irvin Welsh terrain there, underbelly stuff.
Well, I do and I don't. You know, my own reaction to this stuff is very much my reaction to a lot of the crimes I investigate, which is that, you know, there are two things which fuel the kind of behavior that Mr. Welsh describes in his books, from what I understand.
Okay.
From what you said today.
Mm-hmm.
One is just gross ignorance, really. Unmitigated ignorance on the part of the people involved in that.
They just don't know what they're getting into, you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The other
okay.
thing is a very, very strong element of romanticism, a kind of self-dramatization, which, the art of someone like Mr. Welch stimulates and supports.
Wow, that's pretty good, Dave. You haven't read a word, and you're putting a finger right on a button here. Stick with us, Irvin Welsh.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to an extent, I would obviously agree that I think there is a kind of we live in a kind of egotistical society. I think people do, even the poorest people, kind of the most disadvantaged people, want some idea of a compelling drama. And I think,
but have you made your fame and fortune on romanticizing? Hell
not
on Earth.
Really, no. I mean, it's like it's interesting because I've had probably one letter from somebody that said to me that this has encouraged somebody that they know to get into that kind of drug lifestyle, and I've had probably kind of thousands and thousands from people, from parents saying that my son was on the brink of he was involved in this drug scene and he saw Trainspotter and it's totally convinced him that he doesn't want to do that kind of life.
It is not pretty, as you describe it, but yet, you know, the unpretty can have a romantic allure too, of a kind.
I think so. I think it can, yeah. But I think tying into the point the caller made about the ignorance as well, that I think that it's the ignorance that fuels that. I mean, it's like if you have the ignorance and the romance together, then, you know, I think it can influence people in a bad way. But if you have a kind of enlightenment and a knowledge and you show people where this is going to end up, then I think that the kind of romance is the thing that sucks them in. But when you show the sort of whole negative side of it, then I think it's a great thing. I mean, it's like, it's funny when Trainspotting first came out, really got a terrible slagging off by the authorities in Scotland, the health and education authorities, and they would just say no to drugs, and that's a kind of very ignorant stance as well, I think, and that policy has just failed so much. And now you see what you see now is that the health education adverts are basically outtakes from Trainspotting. You know, it's I think it's far more effective.
You don't want to end up here, but we understand what's here in this world.
Well, it's far more effective. I mean, I think you have to be honest and you have to show why people get into that. And I think it is as the caller said, it's like romance and it's ignorance. I mean, when I got into drugs, it was purely for these reasons.
You were a former heroin addict yourself.
Yeah, when I got into drugs, into heroin, I was young and stupid, and I was romantic in that kind of sense. And I think that's exactly, he's nailed it exactly on the head. But I think that we have to, rather than just say no to that, and I think we have to sort of have a whole kind of dialogue that that shows this, but also to show what the ramifications of going on that journey are and how damaging that can be to yourself and people around you.
David, you're the PI, the private investigator, and clearly a smart guy. I mean, this is literature. You don't want just little Bo Peep.
No. It's a tough problem. You know, whether it's the art is a reflection or a generation of the culture we live in. So I don't have an answer to the question.
But it's a good question.
It is a good question, and I think it's an important one. And I mean, I know that when I wrote Trainspotting, nobody was talking about heroin use in Edinburgh. Nobody was talking about HIV and AIDS, and people were dropping down dead. Some of my friends were dropping down dead. And I wrote it as a result of that. And now, you know, the whole drug policy has changed. You have needle exchanges. You have people on methadone, so they're not sharing syringes, and they're not getting sick and getting HIV and dying. And I think it's important that these things are talked about, because I think it's that kind of ignorance that you were talking about, not just on an individual level, but also on a societal level, on a sort of governmental level, and on a kind of administrative and healthcare level that causes so much of the problems.
Well, Irvin Welsh picks it right up. David, thanks for your call. Let me get a call from John in Boston. John, you're on the air with novelist Irvin Welsh.
Hi.
Hi, John.
I just wanted to raise the issue. I thought it was an interesting point what the detective who had called previously had made. I myself am in recovery, and I remember seeing Trainspotting, and I was extremely sensitive to the issues covered.
You're in recovery from drug abuse, from drug addiction.
Yes.
Okay.
And I've experienced a lot of intense things myself, and I didn't actually feel that the movie was completely honest. And I did think that, I mean, of course, there was a lot of romanticism of a lot of that lifestyle and things that just were completely unrealistic.
What was the margin?
Can I ask you what you felt was dishonest about it, John?
I'm sorry?
Can I ask you what you felt was kind of dishonest about the film?
Well, I mean, I remember, you know, being on the street and trying to come up with ways of getting my next fix and just being so focused on that there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, running around having fun, you know, shooting dogs in the park and silly things like that.
What fun.
I mean, I think that the point is, though, that they were on this kind of journey where they were involved, they were getting into it, and they were kicking, and they were getting into it, and they were kicking, and every time they got into it more, you know, the possibilities of them coming off and the chances for them coming off, you know, were becoming less real. You know, and I think also that again that they're upping the stakes in what they were doing in terms of the sort of, you know, the kind of badness of what they were doing.
John, was Trainspotting an icon in that world, in your drug addicted world?
Well, it was. I was in college, and I actually got a late start in college because, you know, I wasted many years on the streets, and I remember my friends in college at the time just thinking how great it was and cool it was, and I guess I felt in a way it was robbing my life experience because these are things that I know about, and it was presenting a different story that I didn't quite agree with.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it's going to be. I suppose that's inevitable to some degree, but here's a different angle. John, thanks for your call.
I think that I had, there's been a lot of criticism of the film. Not so much of the book, because I think it's, you know, again, it's a different medium. The reader can engage with the book in their own time. But I think that with the film, I mean, people have said that it kind of sensationalizes and glamorizes. And I think that
the pacing, the quick cuts.
Yeah,
and the, mm-hmm.
I think that's a criticism of the medium of film. Mm-hmm. And I think probably film does glamorize things. I mean, actors look better than real people, even if they're supposed to be kind of looking grungy and all that.
Right.
So I mean, I kind of, in a way, I think that, you know, the film, anything that becomes a youth culture thing in that way does kind of have a sort of a glamour. But I think people can distinguish between the superficial glamour of something and the actual content of it and what it's saying.
Mm. Irvin Welsh makes quite a story out of it. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. Toller's calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hi, Toller, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I have it's more of a creative question for Irvin.
Please, sure.
One of my favorite books, Trainspotting, of course. One of my other favorite books, The Marabou Stork Nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
As a aspiring creative writing and novels and screenplay, what helps you link like stories together or help them weave in and out like as multiple narratives?
I think really, I mean, it's just a matter of trying it out and seeing if it works. I mean, sometimes it's kind of when you've got a couple of stories that you want to put together in that way, there just seems to be no real kind of rationale or logic for them to go together. But I think you just have to try and find a device that works. I mean, it's like, Marabou's Thought Nightmares, I knew what I wanted to do, and it wasn't, but I just, the whole thing just looked a bit silly and didn't fit together until I started to experiment with the topography and started to use different typo and different kind of ways of putting it, weaving the text in and out of each other, and then the whole thing kind of came to life, you know, to get the guy's different states of consciousness, and also the different language that he was using in these different states of consciousness.
I read once that you would tap into music as a way to sort of visualize even narrative and character.
Very much, like, you know, every character that I do, every main character anyway, I get a playlist for them and get the records. And
so you assign particular cuts of music to the character, and from that you begin to visualize, feel them.
Very much, yeah. I start to feel the mood, and I start to feel the kind of person that they are from the music. So again, getting a playlist together is a thing that I would recommend as well.
Of course, you've got a music background there. Toler, thanks for your call. Urban Welsh, we don't get you often here. We want to get some reading from you. There's a passage early on in the book where Danny Skinner, again, he who is searching for his father and suspects, help introduce this here, he suspects that a kind of a celebrity chef may be related to his search.
Right. Danny Skinner felt his bottom lip curl outwards, the way it always seemed to do when he was undermined and forlorn. He'd done his job. He'd told the truth. Skinner was no naive fool. He knew the real politic of the situation. Some were always more equal than others. But it stuck in his craw that if a Bangladeshi immigrant with a last order's curry house had a kitchen as minging as De Fretis's, then he'd probably never boil an egg in the city again. Right, he said miserably. But maybe he had spiced it up a bit. He didn't like De Fretis, even if he found the man strangely compelling. His copy of The Bedroom Secrets of the Master Chefs was a guilty lunchtime purchase, and it lay concealed in his briefcase. He recalled the opening paragraphs of the foreword, which he'd read with such distaste. The wisest in our midst have long known that the simplest of questions are often the most loaded. With every student of the culinary arts who comes into my orbit, I endeavour to begin our relationship by asking the question, who is the master chef? The responses are never less than instructive and intriguing for me, for in order to assist my own quest for culinary excellence, it's this very question I perennially seem to address. For sure, our master chef must be an artisan, a craftsman who takes a stubborn pride in the painstaking and often mundane details of his métier. Certainly the master chef is also a scientist, but he is more than just a chemist. He is an alchemist, a sorcerer, an artist, and his concoctions are not designed to remedy maladies of body or mind, but to attend the far more wondrous task of uplifting the soul. Our vehicle for the achievement of this objective is food, pure and simple. But this journey must take us along the road of our own human senses. So I contend to my oft-bemused students, and now to you, dear reader, that if the master chef is anything, then he is, and must always be, a complete and utter sensualist.
Urban Welsh reading from his new novel, The Bedroom Secrets of the Master Chef, and Danny Skinner, who's recalling all this from the celebrity chef's foreword. Then, of course, thinks to himself right away, he's just a cook, and he thinks of the anodyne, sexless yuppies who would respond to that. They would actually buy that book in its thousands and make a fat, rich, spoiled fool. Fatter, richer, and more spoiled still. This gets into his search for a paternity. I mean, his mom won't tell him, and his eye turns this way, And it's a search that, full of this duality as he kind of lays off his anger and hatred and the consequences of hatred on poor little Kibby. Duality, a big theme here in the Jekyll and Hyde vein.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I was kind of very interested in, and it's something that that crops up in, you know, as I said, it's cropped up in Scottish literature so often, and Robert Louis Stevenson's probably the most kind of famous exponent of it with Jekyll and Hyde. There's another great Edinburgh story as well that we've actually made into a film that's shooting in January called The Meat Trade. And it's based...
The Meat Trade.
The Meat Trade, yeah. It's starring Bobby Carlyle and Colin Firth. And it's based on another old Edinburgh story, which is the Burke and Hare murders. And Burke and Hare were two guys who basically dug up, you know, they killed people, and they got the procured bodies for the medical scientists of Edinburgh just before the time of the Scottish Enlightenment. And it's reckoned that... the great advances in medical science that happened in Edinburgh and spread across the world were kind of fueled by Burke and Hare's kind of illegal procurement of corpses. So again, you see this duality being respectable kind of medical Edinburgh society and these two Edinburgh labourers who are going around killing people to furnish them with the bodies they need. So the city has always had that kind of sense of duality about it. You can go from... a very kind of smart upmarket district and walk just a few hundred yards and then suddenly you're in a kind of grotty backstreet pub in Leith Walk, you know.
There's another duality right there.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the place really lends itself to that. You've got the kind of, you've got the rundown kind of old town and the sort of posh Georgian new town, and you've just got that kind of, you've always had that thing going on there.
And does the rundown town open up the truth of the posh town? Is it the sort of window into the soul somehow? Why?
I think, yeah, I mean, I think that there's a kind of, there's a conspiracy in every city in the world, there's a conspiracy amongst the well-to-do to pretend that the poorer places just don't exist, they don't have anything to do with them. And it's like, and I think in some ways it's perfectly understandable. I mean, people have got to get on with their own lives and live their own life, and kind of why should they have to sort of engage with the problems of others in that way? But... I think as a kind of, as a society, as a world, you know, as a global community, it doesn't do us any good in the long run. It becomes self-defeating because eventually we do have to sort of see that we have a, you know, the whole thing is interconnected, and if we're doing well, we have a role in all these kind of social problems.
Roger's calling from Fitchburg, Massachusetts. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know, Roger?
Well, firstly, I'm English. I was, you know, brought up in Kent, just outside London.
Yeah.
And I relocated to the US about 10 years ago, and I remember seeing the film when it first came out, the Trainspotting film.
So what do you make of this Mad Scotsman?
Typical north of the border.
Typical north of the border. There's an Englishman speaking. What do you mean?
Hello, sorry, I didn't quite catch
that. Sorry, Roger.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a stereotype back in the UK between, you know, Scotland and England, and particularly where I come from, you know, the Scottish would refer to me as, you know, from the soft south, and the Scottish always talk about short arms and deep pockets. and I won't say what I say about the Welsh.
Yeah, all right. And what do you read in Irvine Welsh?
I was just, you know, very taken by the movie because where I came from and where I grew up, I never ever came across any form of drugs, you know, throughout the 40 years I lived in England. And so to me it was an eye-opener in terms of, you know, what is, you know, happening in other parts of society.
Does that mean that you're the nerdy Brian Kibbe character in this? Which 40 years lately could one grow up and never run into drugs, with all respect?
Well, I'm an engineer, and even at college, and I went to university in Salford, which is, you know, sort of in the northwest of England, and I never came across even pot there. And it was only probably when I was about 30, 35, I went to one party where pot was, you know, participated in. Whereas since moving here to the US, and I'm phoning from, you know, Massachusetts, but I live just north over the border in New Hampshire. It's every man and his dog smokes pot. And my wife, likes it. I work for a utility company, and I'm subject to random drug testing. So,
yes, please stay sober in that case, Roger.
Yeah. Well, let me.
But it's a different scene, you're saying.
Yeah, it's a completely different scene, and deserving see that in terms of, in generality, is, drugs more prevalent in the US versus the UK?
We got it. Roger, thanks for your call. Irvin Welsh.
I would say it's much more prevalent in the UK, Roger. I think all parts of the UK now as well. I think in the US it's a kind of sort of urban sort of thing, but I can't even say that, but I think that certainly kind of Class A drugs seem to be very, very prevalent in the UK now, just almost everywhere. But I would assume that in the States, particularly in the bigger cities, it will be quite similar to that.
Irvin Welsh, let me ask you about your relationship with your life in the States. You taught creative writing in Chicago for a while. You ended up marrying one of your students.
I didn't marry one of my students, no.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstand. Well, a young American woman.
Yeah.
Just a year ago this summer, congratulations.
Yeah.
And you've talked about moving to California. So what do you make of the States? Is it attractive? Obviously,
yeah, I think in a lot of ways it is. There's a lot of things that I like about the USA that I kind of don't like about the UK. And I think one of the I think the things is that there's a kind of... much more kind of relaxed attitude to things here in a lot of ways. I mean, I think that one of the differences that I like about the USA is that in Britain there still is this very kind of sort of penny pinching kind of imperial kind of weights and measures type mentality, whereas it's like kind of like working people in Britain don't really expect anything. They've been sort of they've basically been lied to and deceived for years and years by their kind of their supposed betters. And
so here we just put it all on the credit card and go into debt, and that's better.
Yeah, well, in Britain they're still waiting on these kind of homes fit for heroes that they were promised in after the First World War. Mm. They're still waiting to get them, but in America it's just a kind of attitude that. People feel, the working man in America feels like entitled to a big steak or to a sort of kind of a big sort of drink.
Why not?
But I think that's a tremendously brilliant thing, and you don't get that in Britain. I think people have been kind of, particularly working class people, have been beaten down into expecting absolutely nothing.
California, what kind of destination is that for a cloudy, gloomy Edinburgh?
Yeah, I lived in San Francisco for a while, and I liked it there. And I was thinking about maybe moving to Southern California for a bit, just to get more light and so I can get up earlier in the morning and sort of do more work and get on with things a bit easier.
And you're married to an American woman, but you sound so archetypally Scottish. What kind of bridging was required for that relationship culturally?
I think you just forget. Eventually, it's weird when we speak to each other on the phone. We kind of realize that I'm American, she's American, and I'm Scottish, and it's kind of weird. But you forget about it most of the time.
Voice reminds you on the phone.
Yeah, the voice reminds you on the phone.
Isn't there.
But, I think when we talk to each other, I probably sound a bit more American than I do now, and she probably sounds a bit more Scottish. Mm.
And it brings me back to the new novel, where Bedroom Secrets, Master Chefs, where you don't use as much of the kind of deep Scottish slang as you did in earlier books. And I wonder why not. I remember with Trainspotting, I'd see people Americans, just straining and straining. And when it was out on video, DVD, get down by the TV, to put their ear right next to the speaker to try and figure out what these characters were saying in that deep, deep brogan slang. What's backed you away from it this time?
I think with this one, it really wasn't. There's still quite a bit of vernacular in it, but the narrative is in standard English, because I was thinking about the differences. I mean, if you have if you go right back to Trainspotting, the characters there are very much in their own subculture, so they reference each other for their for their narrative. Their whole narrative is designed from each other, the group thing and the peer pressure. These guys are both in the world of work. They're both in this kind of middle class sort of professional world, and they're both ambitious within that world. So it makes more sense that their narrative would be more a kind of standard English kind of sort of business world sort of kind of narrative, and that was the reason to have that.
Let me turn to a caller, if I may. Irvin Welsh, Dorothy's calling from Boston. Hi, Dorothy, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. What do you know, Dorothy?
Hi, Dorothy.
Hello. Well, I just wanted to say that I have read the majority of Mr. Welch's books, and
Filth
I,
and Glue and Porno and Ecstasy and all that jazz.
Yes, all of those, actually.
Yeah.
And I'm very middle class, very ordinary upbringing. I've never been a heroin addict in Edinburgh or a police detective with a sex addiction. However, his writing is just so honest and so brutal, but there's no judgment, no matter what characters he's depicting and what their lifestyles are and what vile things they're doing. It's just very matter of fact. It's just, this is the way it is. This is the way these people live. And it draws you in, no matter what your background is.
And is that honesty exciting, liberating for you? What the appeal?
It makes me understand how other people think outside of my own limited background. And it makes me understand their motivations, whereas otherwise I would see someone like that and maybe dismiss them. And this way I understand what goes on in their mind, maybe a little bit.
Oh, that's a big thumbs up and a good one. Honesty's got to be a high compliment.
I think it's like kind of you try to get to a kind of honesty within yourself as a writer, and it's like one of the interesting things is like I do journalism as well, and it's like I don't find
Darfur and a number.
Yeah,
of
I mean I don't find it satisfying because you've got so much responsibility to tell the truth, to get your facts right, and I think that the way I look at journalism, it's always people. You know, it's like you're trying to build a lie, basically. On a sort of bed of facts, and I think that's what a lot
build
of
a lie
yeah,
meaning to
that's
put,
what I think put, a lot of journalism
to lay a theory
is.
Of the yeah. case over yes. facts that can't yes. necessarily yeah. amount to one.
It's building a case. It's building a kind of subjective view on a series of facts. Whereas I think fiction's the opposite. I think what you can do with fiction is because you're not under any pressure to tell the truth, and you're making things up. You're making up things that are just basically lies and nonsense and all that. But you can get to deeper truths, at least within yourself. And that's
what about the
do.
No judgment factor that Dorothy compliments you for? You've been called a kind of contemporary Dickens. Dickens was a judge in the end. He was making points with his work. How about you?
I don't think you can. I mean, I think you've got to, if you create a character, you've got to let them speak for themselves without the kind of author intervening and filtering it through some kind of lens to make it either more safe or more kind of sort of palatable for people. I mean, it's like, I'm not really interested in doing that. I'm interested in kind of getting into the heads of characters who seem a bit extreme and seem a bit damaged and trying to understand them. And that isn't necessarily about liking them or about disliking them. It's about just trying to understand where they're coming from.
Dorothy, thanks for your call. Rich is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Rich. You're on the air with Irvin Welsh.
Hi. Pleasure to talk to you.
Hi, Rich.
Originally when I called, I was going to say that I thought that your works... you know, or nihilistic, kind of self-centered, that I was into them at one time. And then as I listened to people talk, I realized that I think what the situation is it really depends on where you're at. When I was in my early 20s, your stories meant a lot to me. But I was also into Kafka. I was into Camus. I was in, you know, the nihilistic writing or the existentialism writing. And now, you know, it's 10 years on, and I just find that I'm looking for something more positive in writing, and it almost sounds like it might be there in your new book. Do you find as you get older, as your outlook changing? Do you think? And then I'm also wondering if maybe I'm not from the background that you're from, and maybe I thought it was interesting, exciting, that type of thing. And then as I got older, I realized I wanted to go for writing that had more of a positive appreciation of life, and that. Maybe I'm not appreciating your books as much because I'm wondering if someone like me, who was younger, might be influenced and take it the wrong way. And so, what I'm trying to say is,
I think Richard, we got it. It's a great string of questions. Yeah. Irvin's nodding right along here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's valid what you say, Richard. I think we're all on a kind of. We're all on a kind of journey, and I think our tastes and our sensibilities change through time. You know, I think minds have changed a lot as I've been writing, and you know, they're constantly changing as well. I've always wanted to do stuff positive for literature. I've never wanted to write a kind of book that's just kind of. I've never wanted to write a book that just goes along and ticks about and doesn't get any kind of reaction from people. I do want to kind of get some kind of reaction and kind of make important points and all that. But I do think that...
But are you looking for the light? Rich has gotten older, maybe he thinks wiser, and he's looking for the uplift, the positive...
I think I'm looking for the light, but I'm trying to work my way through the darkness as well to sort of to find it. And I think that... I think with writing as well, I think, you know, with literature, I think we get into different things at different times, and we're constantly sort of looking for different things too. I mean, it's like kind of what floats your boat at a certain time in your life might not float your boat other times. I think that's kind of perfectly understandable. Mm. I mean, I'm on a journey as a writer, and I know that, you know, this like kind of when you're on that journey, you're going to, you know, you lose some people on the way, like any journey. You bring in a lot of other people on the way, hopefully, and that's kind of the way it is, and I think the way it has to be, really.
Rich, thanks for calling from Buffalo. We got a call from Palm Springs, California. Audrey is on the line. Hi, Audrey, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Hi, Audrey.
Good morning, Mr. Welsh. I'm from Edinburgh myself, actually, an older lady. I could be your granny, I'm sure. Love your books, but wondered if you would ever write anything that wasn't just drug-related.
Sonny.
Yeah, I mean... I think I do write things that aren't drug related. I mean, I think it's difficult. You know, I think it's like the kind of to me, I don't really see myself as writing about drugs. In fact, I think it's like kind of I just feel there's so much a kind of unremarkable sort of part of kind of modern urban life, particularly in kind of youth culture. And I'm kind of writing about people that are quite a bit younger than myself now, and it's, you know, so it's like. I think to not write about it, it's a bit like kind of writing about the Highlands of Scotland and not writing about the scenery, you know, the mountains or the greenery. You know, it's just a part of the kind of the landscape, really.
But I read you stepping away a bit in this book. I mean, they're not really the point of this book, drugs. There's another narrative structure here.
I don't think that kind of drugs was even the point of Trainspotting. Mm-hmm. I think it was about group. You know, the power of the group and peer group pressure, and how people do things that they wouldn't sort of do as individuals when they get into gangs and groups. And I think this is about kind of like rivalry rather than alcohol as a drug. You know, the drug is a kind of cipher in a way.
The rivalry, even the hatred. Audrey, thanks for your call from Palm Springs. I should say there's an excerpt from The Bedroom Secrets of the Master Chefs, Irvin Welsh's latest book, up at our website, onpointradio.org. A couple of things I have to ask you about. One, to get the hex off, because he tires of his pain, the pain of his bad behavior being transferred onto Kibby. Your guy goes to a witch, and the price she asks for his advice is, this is a large older woman, she asks for sex with him as the price of taking off the hex. You've been criticized for your lavish description of that is misogynist. How do you take that?
I don't think that's a serious sort of criticism, really. I mean, it's like I think that when you've got somebody that's kind of coercing a younger guy into having sex, I don't think that's misogynistic at all. I think if it was the other way around, an older guy coercing a young woman to having sex, it probably would be misogynistic. But I don't know what the kind of the reverse of that is, the kind of female exploiting male equivalent of misogynism is. I don't know if there's a word for it.
And your last thought here, Treatise on Hatred, and as he comes out of the hex, he's thinking about the United States. What is there a lesson for the USA in The Bedroom Secrets of the Master Chefs?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's up to the kind of any reader to take what they want out of it. I think your kind of role as a writer is very much within the text, contained within the text. And I mean, I think there's a lesson. Hopefully, there's a lesson for everybody. But that depends. I mean, it's kind of the great thing about being a novelist is that you don't really feel the need to kind of preach. You just need to sort of write what you feel within on the blank page, and people can take it as they find it.
The blank page is not at all blank. It's roiling here, and we're grateful for you spending the time with us today, Irvin Welsh. Thanks so much for coming by.
Cheers.
Irvin Welsh, author of Trainspotting, Ecstasy, Filth, Glue, Porno. The latest is The Bedroom Secrets of the Master Chefs. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.